Charles Eisenstein. Da-da-da. And he seems to have been in the news this week. Kanka, you came across something of his?
Well, it's on the daily.
Sirotown Books once. He came to talk, and I think about six people came to hear him. I met him at a conference years ago, and he taught at Goddard for a while as well, so he's got some connections here. All right, well, I don't know where he's originally from, but he lived in Pennsylvania for a long time, in Harrisburg. All right, so let's go back to the beginning, though. He was born in 1967, which makes him 50.
He doesn't, baby.
He doesn't look it on that picture, but he turned 50 this year. He studied philosophy and mathematics at Yale, but even that experience didn't answer his questions about the world. He found himself wondering why things are the way they are. And the way he puts it, he was driven by wondering, what is the origin of the wrongness in the world? So he was deeply troubled. So he left the U.S. He went to live in Taiwan. There was something about Chinese thought that attracted him. He learned Chinese. He became a translator of ancient texts, studied Asian religion and philosophy. And after several years, came back to the U.S. and continued his studies. He studied yoga. He was also studying Chinese medicine. He's not a practicing acupuncturist, but he understands the principles of it. And then he started research for what became his first book. It's called The Ascent of Humanity. It came out in 2007. And the title might sound a little bit familiar because there was a book back in 1968 or 70 called The Ascent of Man by a guy named Bronowski, which was a celebration of how wonderful civilization is and how clever we have become, and we've conquered all these aspects of nature. And Eisenstein deliberately played off that title and his thesis is a little bit different. Otherwise, we wouldn't be talking about him today. But we'll talk more about what he means by the ascent of humanity. 2011, he came out with his second book called Sacred Economics. And then in 2013, another book called, and you'll like this title, The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible. This is why we close the course with him, because he looks at all of this dark stuff, but he ends up on a fairly positive note. So he does go around speaking. He publishes essays on the web. I think he has his own blog, his own website. For a number of years, he was contributing to a very strange website called Reality Sandwich. And I don't necessarily recommend it. There's a lot of pretty bizarre stuff there, but his essays there were really quite astounding and worth reading. I don't know if they're all still archived there, but that might be where. I came across that and have read most of that. But his books are pretty comprehensive. He taught at Penn State and lived in Harrisburg, and I have heard that he's since moved to North Carolina.
That's where I'm going.
That's where you're going?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, say hi for me.
Okay, well.
I don't know exactly where he is or exactly what he's doing right now, but he gets around. All right, so what does he say? He is in the same ballpark as all these other authors we're talking about because he recognizes that we are at a crisis point, that we as a culture are in trouble right now. And here's how he puts it. For people immersed in the study of any of the crises that afflict our planet, it becomes abundantly clear that we are doomed. Politics, finance, energy, education, healthcare, and most importantly, the ecosystem, are headed toward near certain collapse. The dashed utopian dreams of the last few centuries leave little hope. Despite the miracles we have produced, people across the ideological spectrum, from Christian fundamentalists to environmental activists, share a foreboding that the world is in grave and growing peril. So he acknowledges this.
I thought you said he was more upbeat.
More upbeat.
He's going to be upbeat. Give him time.
Yes.
The more beautiful world our thoughts think are possible.
Our hearts know is possible.
Our hearts know is possible.
When was that written as opposed to when was The Ascent of Humanity written?
Well, the quote I just gave you was from Ascent of Humanity, so that's 2007, and The More Beautiful World came out 6 years later, 2013. But I don't think his thinking changed over that time. He actually does end on a positive note in Ascent of Humanity.
You don't want to know the truth.
Well,
sometimes it's better not to.
I think what he's trying to get across, and it's not that different from many of these other writers, and the whole reason I wanted to give this course, is first we have to acknowledge how bad things are. We need to acknowledge that the present culture, the present form of civilization has reached its end game, its final phase, it's in decline. And so, yes, that's scary. That's going to lead to a lot of difficulty. But it's also an opening. It means that we get to start over, or we get to transition into something different. That's what this magazine is all about, right? And he, I think more than the other authors, Eisenstein sees a kind of underlying purpose in this evolution. He said that human consciousness, the human mind, needed to go through this long, long process of differentiation, of Jung would say individuation, right? That we've separated ourselves from nature, we've tested out all of our abilities, all the possible things we can do to the planet, and now we've reached the point we can't do anymore. We've taken it as far as we can, and now we see that there's nothing left. And now we return as a species. We can return to our connection with nature. He calls this the age of reunion. So that's where he's optimistic. But he says, first you have to acknowledge where we are, because we're not going to be ready to let go of this old culture. That's a very tough thing to do, is to say that everything you've learned about what's real, what's natural, what's normal, what is human potential, all the assumptions that are built into us, you don't just one day decide to let go of those. They're ingrained in us. And it's only when we can acknowledge that they're not working anymore, they've reached the end of the line, that's when we can let go and say, let's try something different. So that's why it's important to look in the face of all the all these crises. So that's his starting point. Although the first quote here came from page 431, so maybe that's not the starting point. But for approaching these issues, that's where you need to start, to acknowledge. So one of the problems with our current civilization is the law of diminishing returns, which other of these authors have also pointed to this. So when science and technology first got rolling 300 or 400 years ago, every new breakthrough was huge. We were creating this whole new civilization from what was an agricultural society. No one moved any faster than the speed of a horse. Right, communications were slow and local, and the new inventions, the new developments of industrial society, changed that completely. This rapid expansion of our powers and our ability, the rapid expansion of speed, and as we get further and further into it, the developments are less and less dramatic. The system has become so interconnected, so complex that you can make a breakthrough in some field or some science, but it's not going to change the whole thing. It's going to be incremental. And the big breakthroughs that we thought were coming, of overcoming disease or reaching Mars or all these big things, they seem further and further away. We never quite get there. We say, well, we're always making progress, except that we're not. So that's the first clue, he says, that that this further development of industrial society is not going to be able to continue much longer. And what we see more and more are the unintended consequences, the damage that's done with each new technology, each new addition to the complexity. Technological progress has failed to deliver on many of its promises. Medicine has not conquered disease. Agriculture has not overcome pests. Mechanization and computers have not given us a substantial increase in leisure time. Right? We were supposed to have lots of time now that machines do everything for us. Instead, it has sped up the pace of life where we can hardly keep up. More people are beginning to doubt the promise of technology and progress and recognizing the costs of those things. And his conclusion is that the collapse we are facing is a collapse of a whole way of relating to the world, a whole way of being, a whole definition of self. At the root of our technological addiction is our own off-separation from the universe, our self-conception as discrete and separate beings that goads us toward control. Let's take that apart word by word here. So off-separation, it's kind of an awkward term, but he means separating off, becoming alienated from, becoming distanced or detached from. We'll see in a minute that he looks at indigenous people, at pre-civilized, pre-industrial people, and says they are immersed in the cosmos. Everything around them speaks to them. Everything has soul. Everything is, to use a term from Morris Berman's work, the world is an enchanted, right? Which means it's not a dead cosmos. It's not just a force of, it's not a collection of physical forces blindly acting on each other. There's something purposeful in the universe. And before we created this sophisticated civilization, humanity was able to experience that directly. He says, now we can't. We are separated, that we have contracted our sense of self to our individual identities. You have that phrase from the 60s from Alan Watts. He talked about the skin-encapsulated ego. So when you say, well, who am I? What's my identity? Well, it's this body, and it's my own personal history and my memories and my experiences. That's who I am. Now, to us, that makes common sense. That's right? I mean, how can you argue with that? And that's the point of saying that the whole worldview is changing. That's no longer going to be common sense. When we identify with the rest of nature, the rest of creation, then when you ask someone, who are you, ultimately, they would conceive of themselves differently. They would be connected to everything. So that's what he wants to get across here, is that this shift from modern industrial civilization to whatever's coming next is a shift of how we see ourselves, how we experience ourselves. It's much deeper than what kind of energy we use or who's in the White House or even what kind of economic system we have. It's this deep sense of who we are and our place in the universe. Is that fairly clear? Breakdown of what we have now, the breakdown of all of our systems and our worldview will leave us in this open space, this place of not knowing. He calls it a sacred space, right, where anything is possible. Right, that is certainly possible. But maybe we are starting to wake up just in time, and as this magazine shows, and as many thousands of people around the world are finding, that it is possible to live differently. Maybe we'll do it in time, but we don't know. Less developed countries may have access to that at some point.
And the third world countries have a lot of problems.
Eisenstein spends quite a bit of his writing on describing a pre-industrial or pre-civilized way of life. He says this is how human beings evolved over hundreds of thousands of years. This is essentially who we are. So he talks about hunter-gatherer societies. He said, for one thing, they don't exhibit much anxiety over scarcity. They share what they have. They feel that nature freely gives to support them. If the place they're living is starting to wear thin, they move on. Hunter-gatherers are more nomadic. If their sustenance is growing a little short, they share with each other. No one feels that they're going to be left behind, that they're going to starve while everyone else does well. So this idea of scarcity, he argues, is a more modern experience, this feeling that we don't have enough. And he says that comes from our separation. That doesn't come from objective conditions in the world. It comes from we've cut ourselves off from that sense of receiving gifts and feeling at home in the universe. We're always looking for more. We never have enough.
How do anthropologists?
I think your question just should remind us that we have to be critical in all that we're reading here. So Eisenstein doesn't know for sure about any of this. This is his best interpretation of what he's read, and if something doesn't sound right, it's worth following up and pursuing it and saying, how do we know this?
Well, of course, the anthropologists don't just...
Right, another claim that Eisenstein makes about indigenous society is that they don't have a need for God. They don't need a master controller somewhere up in the clouds, because everything is sacred. Everything is filled with this life-giving force. So they don't need religion as we know it. So think of the word itself, the word religion. L-I-G is the root for the same word as ligament. It's something that connects, and religion is to reconnect, to get back in touch with something that's been lost. And Eisenstein says in indigenous cultures, they've never lost it. So they don't experience nature as something separate, something outside of them, and most importantly, as a resource, something that they have to take in order to live, that it's freely given. So he does acknowledge that the beginnings of separation, of this experience of being different and outside of nature, it must have started early on, that there's something about the human mind or just about the way we're built, that at some point individuals must have started to have a sense of gee, I am different, I am separate from what's around me. And in his scheme of things, he said that's part of our journey, that we shouldn't be sorry that happened. We needed to take this journey of individuating, of separating. But when it came to agriculture, then this separation took on much more force. we got more and more separated by having land and staying in one place and making nature give us what we wanted. And then, of course, the scientific and industrial revolutions separated us even further. But he doesn't blame agriculture or industrialization. He says it's a psychic evolution that was going to happen one way or another. But here's what it was like when agriculture came along. Along with the gradual shift to agriculture came a transformation in human attitudes toward nature. Hunting accords with a view of other animals as equals. Nature works that way. Some eat and some are eaten. And the human hunter is doing nothing different from animal hunters. Domestication, though, imposes a hierarchy onto the interspecies relationship as man becomes lord and master of the animals. Understandably, this relationship is then projected onto the whole of nature, which becomes in its entirety the object of domestication and control. So it's this attitude that he's really examining. Why do we feel like we need to master and control the nature around us? Why can't we just accept the gifts and live in harmony with it? He says there's a deep psychic need for control. Because we've lost that connection and feel empty in that way, we have to gain control, we have to gain mastery. Any comments on any of that so far? For Eisenstein, civilization implies separation. It's a way of detaching ourselves, and he gets pretty explicit in how that happens. So first of all, he says, underlying the vast swath of ruin our civilization has carved is not human nature, but the opposite, human nature denied. We have defined ourselves as other than what we are, as discrete subjects separate from each other and separate from the world around us. The paradigm of ever-ascending understanding and control represents a fundamental myth of our culture, which I call the ascent of humanity. It is the belief that someday we will transcend nature completely. The economic man, the rational actor, the Cartesian I am, is a delusion that cuts us off from most of what we are, leaving us lonely and small. Is that term clear, the Cartesian I am, you know, that refers to Descartes' statement that I think, therefore I am. Right, so that's our worldview, right? We're, what I know, what I can think with my mind, that's my identity. And Eisenstein is saying that we're much more than that. We are everything in nature that has gone into creating us. So here are the kinds of things that bring about these notions of the economic man and the rational actor. So one is language itself. Language is a powerful tool. It's an important tool, but in an advanced civilization, it does more to separate us from our experience than to connect us, especially as it gets more abstract and more technical, more filled with jargon and specialized terminology. It's always more abstract, more limited than the actual experience that it's trying to describe. And the more we substitute language for the experience, that increases our distance. Now this next one is harder to wrap our heads around because of our enculturation. But so I don't quite get this. But he says time, the concept of time, separates us. That for an indigenous person, there's just now. This is all there is, right now. And of course, spiritual teachings also try to get that point across. There really is no past or future. It's all now. It's a succession of nows. And it's only because we have this concept of time and try to measure it and have words to talk about yesterday and tomorrow that we think time is something real. It's hard to get your head around that, but he goes further. He says, think about a clock. A clock is the only machine that doesn't do anything. It just goes around and around. What's it doing? It's measuring something that doesn't exist, he says. But it gives the illusion that it exists. It regiments our experience into before and after. And that the Industrial Revolution wouldn't have been possible without the clock.
We're all time study men.
Another invention of civilization which separates us from our spontaneous experience is the machine, just the idea of a machine, which is a mechanism for organizing, regimenting, and controlling our efforts. It standardizes things. So you lose that presence. You lose the spontaneity. Just an aside here, when public schools were organized in the 1830s in the U.S., one of the top priorities was to take agricultural people who were used to working in organic rhythms. They would work hard for a while, then they'd stop and rest in the shade or whatever. They followed their bodies, their needs. Oh, it's time to rest. It's time to get something to drink. Factories were developing in the early 1800s, and you take workers from the fields and put them into a factory, and you can't work like that anymore. It has to be regimented, it has to be standardized, and so public schooling was a way of training people to work in that more mechanical environment. Eisenstein says, "We think of machines as our servants, but our constant rush to be on time says otherwise." So the machine, like the clock, the machine drives us. It schedules us. It gives us a niche or a role to play where we can't be ourselves. We can't respond to our organic needs in the moment. And then all of society can be seen as a machine.
Didn't have time, I can't imagine what it would be like. I mean, the only way to deal with it is to be in small groups again. It's the only possible.
Yeah. Yes, a large civilization, a large country, whatever, a large economic system depends on this kind of regimentation. It would fall apart without it.
Yeah, but we can only get out of it by going into small groups again. Are we going to meet again?
Eisenstein also makes the point that we are now substituting images and symbols for real experience. And this is not a critique of art. He's not saying we shouldn't have art, but he's talking about how we're completely surrounded by advertising and screens and other things that distance us from being present and experiencing things directly. It creates a fictional world that keeps us insulated from the actual living world.
So, I keep hearing about people.
He turns his critical eye onto science. He says, science claims to reveal objective truths. This is just the fact. This is just the way it is. But like other culturally shaped worldviews, science is a vast and elaborate articulation of the defining myth of our civilization, that we are discrete and separate selves living in an objective universe of others. Science presupposes, embodies, and reinforces this myth, blinding us to other ways of thinking, living, and being. And he criticizes the early scientists like Descartes and Galileo for objectifying our world, putting us into a what he calls a bare and depopulated universe. There was the German sociologist Max Weber at the turn of the 20th century talked about the disenchantment of the world, that the scientific revolution took the magic out of it, took the life force, so that where indigenous people would feel akin to all other beings and even to the earth itself, we now objectify it. It's just rock. It's just an animal. It has no consciousness. It has no connection to us. That's the disenchantment of nature. And Eisenstein said this is really one of our big problems today. He asks, are we happier? Are we more at home or more at peace in the world because of science? He says no, because it cannot resolve our basic existential questions. It's a tool for measuring or observing particular aspects. He's not saying to throw it all away, but we have overused it. We've become over-reliant on this culturally shaped way of understanding. How much of humanity's depredation, violence, and ruination arises from the cosmic alienation implicit in a mechanical universe? The absolute Cartesian universe is at best an approximation, a mathematical tool useful for solving a very narrow range of problems. And then he observes that even within science, in the 20th century, this evolving field of quantum mechanics is starting to question those basic assumptions, that the world is solid and objective and separate from our relationship to it. So I don't understand quantum mechanics, but one of the principles that it embraces is that observing something actually changes it. I don't know how this can be, but that the object you're studying is different because you're studying it.
There's a great film made in Portland.
Even though that's arising within science, most of the scientific establishment still acts as if that's not a major critique. There's still this underlying worldview of separation and objectification, and that leads to a lot of the damage that we're doing to the world. Scientific reductionism prevents us from acknowledging that everything exists in relationship, in context. The most essential qualities that make human life worthwhile, beauty, love, sacredness, they're all about relationship. They're all about context. How can it be that we have created a religion, science, that explicitly denies the very fabric of human experience? By objectifying the world and everything in it, by making an other of the world, we necessarily objectify ourselves as well. The self becomes a lonely and isolated ego. Such a self, cut off from its true nature, will always be insecure and will always try to exert more and more control over the environment. That's his diagnosis for what ails us. So if it's a worldview, if it's a sense of self, or I'll use the word epistemology, of this is what we know is real. If that's the source of our problems, then if you shift that, we can build a new civilization. And that's what he's trying to tell us, that we can see ourselves and our relationship to the world in a very different way. And that people are starting to do that as they realize that this old way is just not working anymore. I read this in the past. I would often come across writers who would say there's a difference between science and scientism. So science is a method that enables us to check our assumptions and test our hypotheses, right, and have independent verification. That's a method, and it works for many purposes. So he's not saying to give that up. But then you take that method and you say, well, this totally explains how the world works. Then it becomes a religion. It becomes scientism. Like, we figured it all out. Our brain can measure and analyze, and now we know what nature is. And that's what he's against, of objectifying everything through that approach. You can still use science, but you use it more modestly. I'll keep going. Maybe an example in the field of psychology, right? That whole movement toward behaviorism, right? Where they said, if you really want to be scientific, you have to get rid of thoughts and fantasies and dreams. And that's not real.
Subjective.
Right, that's all subjective. We don't care about that. What we want to measure behavior. We want to be able to document every little piece of behavior, right? So is that science or is that scientism? Right, that's arbitrarily defining phenomena out of the picture.
Well, patterns that
repeat
themselves.
Right. So a scientific method identifies patterns. But if as a psychologist you say, I don't care about subjective states, I don't care what you're thinking, because that's just your brain generating random noise. I'm only interested in your outward behavior, and I'll find patterns in your behavior, right? So it's a scientific method, but you're arbitrarily not studying patterns in other places. You're ruling them out. And Eisenstein says that's the most essential part of who we are, that you're ruling out. Of experience, thinking, feeling.
By using
all this and thinking in these new ways, that we will achieve a new culture, or as Proust said, do we have enough time before we destroy the planet? There's no guarantee that it's going to work. But if we don't step outside that frame and think differently, then for sure we're not going to succeed. We're just going to keep doing the same destructive things we've been doing. So that's the point of all this, is we don't have a chance unless we change our worldview.
Well, what about creativity?
Eisenstein spends a lot of time talking about money. He sees money as a symbol and as well as a cause of the separation and the breakdown of culture. His second book, Sacred Economics, is a long exploration of that, but he talks about it in all his work. And where does money come from, or why is it so central to our culture? It's because we believe that everything that's real can be measured. It's because only objective, measurable things are real, that value must be something we can measure. And so we give money an extra power that it really shouldn't have, because like the clock, it's a way of measuring something abstract. So he wants us to acknowledge that money itself is just an abstraction. It has no inherent value. You can take out a $100 bill and it's a piece of paper. It's worth a penny maybe in paper and ink. It has value because we've made a cultural agreement that it has value, and we exchange it on that basis. It facilitates anonymous transactions and prevents the exchange of gifts. Or it substitutes for the exchange of gifts. So in Sacred Economics, he wants to emphasize the notion of a gift economy, which he says indigenous people practice. They freely give to each other, and this creates an interconnected set of obligations and relationships. Whereas money separates us. When you buy something from someone, there's no further obligation. You pay them the money and you're gone. It can be completely anonymous.
So they don't trade then, indigenous?
Basically, about sharing, and there may be other things that happen in it, but our culture is basically about paying for things, even though we also have gift giving. Right? He wouldn't claim that no one ever gives gifts. But money has taken a central place in the culture.
But what would you say about Japan?
I don't know. Is there more gift giving there?
If you ever admire...
I don't think he's making an absolute statement about any of this, that it's that in every case it always works like this. He's talking about the dominant trend, and that Japan would be a country that has a traditional culture behind it that got mixed with capitalism and industrialization. So it's different from us. But here's how he puts this point. When we pay professionals to grow our food, prepare our food, create our entertainment, make our clothes, build our houses, clean our houses, treat our illnesses, and educate our children, what's left? What's left on which to base community? Real communities are interdependent. So the problem here, as he describes it, is the professional that you pay is interchangeable with any other professional. If you don't like how they're doing something, you go find someone else. If you can get a better price, you find someone else. It creates no lasting connections or obligations to each other, and that's what a community is, our ongoing relationships. In advanced society, social capital is converted into money. So social capital, even the term itself is kind of reductionistic, right? But it means what we bring to our communities, just as who we are, our skills and our willingness to help each other, our willingness to pitch in for the common good. That's social capital. And he says it's converted into money. You pay for everything you need. Now, again, it's not an absolute position here. Obviously, there are volunteers. There's a lot of social capital still out there. But as our global capitalist system keeps advancing, we have less and less of social capital. It is diminishing. And it takes more and more effort to keep it intact. You know, all this is making me think that I should start getting paid for my teaching.
No, I was going to bring that up.
You want to keep the halo.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And it's part of community.
That's right. I know. That's why I do it.
You just forgot for a minute.
It was that cookie that he had.
That's good payment. That's payment enough.
What
yes.
You thinking
of? So he goes on and says, there is something monstrous about the very idea of a wage, the sale of one's time that is the sale of one's life. Now, that's maybe unthinkable in our culture, in our system, to say, oh, let's get rid of paid labor. I mean, how could that possibly work without that? But again, he is stepping outside of that frame of our worldview and looking at other very different cultures and saying you can have a system without wage labor. Yeah. And let's think about it for a minute. What have we created with the system of wage labor?
Well, the steps wouldn't have gotten fixed.
Not in this system, no. We wouldn't have volunteered for that. And so because of the way we've set this up with a system based on money, we have created artificial scarcity, that the two are related. Putting a price on everything leads to scarcity. There isn't actual scarcity. There's plenty to go around, but you have to have money to get it. This is a point that the people in the global food movement have been making. Francis Moore LePay has been talking about this for decades. There's plenty of food to feed everyone on the planet. Why are a billion people starving? It's all about how it's distributed. It's all about scarcity that's created by the system that we've set up. So we experience constant anxiety about scarcity and survival. Here's a long quote from Eisenstein. Scarcity and the threat of scarcity is implicit in the attempted mastery of nature. Jockeying for position in the face of scarcity, we endure an endlessly intensifying competitiveness that is built into our system of money, our understanding of biology, and our assumptions about human nature. So the competitiveness isn't natural to us. It's a response to this artificial scarcity. And it leads to an obsession with control. Right? We're desperate to survive. We're desperate to have enough, so we try to control the environment. The sense of mission that drove the Europeans to civilize and colonize the world also infuses our science. To civilize is to make tame, to bring order to colonize is to make subservient. Science colonizes the world for technology. So if you're as most of us are, we appreciate a lot of what science has brought us, right? And we don't want to throw science out completely. But he is saying that science serves the purpose in this culture of giving us mastery, giving us control over natural processes for our benefit, regardless of the damage that it does. It's a way of our colonizing, of humans colonizing the rest of the natural world. We want to control everything that we define as being outside of us and everything that's out of our control. So in this worldview, we need to manage the body and natural impulses. We need to manage unruly children. We need to isolate people who are different from us and who are threatening, and we need to manage nature itself. We can do better meeting our needs by manipulating nature than by receiving its gifts. And he points out, as Derek Jensen does, this urge to manage and control ultimately always leads to violence. You have to be violent if you're going to exert this kind of control. The compulsion to control the world arises out of an alienation which has shorn life of any meaning except the maximization of comfort, safety, and pleasure. And he talks about how this shows up in the proliferation of rules and regulations. So in this complex, top-heavy bureaucratic society that we have, our behaviors are, and the roles that we play are constricted. There are rules for everything. There are procedures. There are techniques. I have this image of the tax code, right? And this stack of books that's on the legislator's desk. Or this top shelf here. These are the Vermont annotated statutes, right? There's a law for everything, right? Everything has to be standardized and controlled. Now, it's not to say, again, it's not to say we throw out all the laws. Don wouldn't have had a job if we did that. We don't throw out all laws, but it's a question of degree, of extent. And he's making the point that we have so few realms left for spontaneous action or organic, you know, meeting our needs organically, because everything is prescribed. I think about our diets. you follow this diet or that diet, or you want so many milligrams of this vitamin or that vitamin. And someone reminded me last night, they had read another book by Eisensteiner. It talks about eating organically. You just eat what your impulses tell you need to eat.
Oh, brother.
Well, he looks in pretty good shape for a 50-year-old guy. So
he's an advocate for just organics, right? That's what
I would think so.
Yeah.
But
he's saying let your body tell you what you need, not let your social circle tell you what you need to eat.
Right. So your social circle and science, right?
Right.
So, we could go down that whole road. I don't think I will. But the point is that in this culture, there's just so much regulation. And he's not saying it as a libertarian conservative and saying, oh, let's get rid of government, let's get rid of laws. He's just saying from the point of view of a human animal trying to meet its needs in the world, we are just hemmed in so many ways by this social machine.
And Ron, could you just add into that, of course, I think one of my...
At an alternative education conference, he was homeschooling his kids, he and his wife were homeschooling, and he came to talk about organic ways of learning at this conference, so that's important to him as well.
How many kids do
you have? I think two.
And would he suggest?
It's got a lot of different motives to it, and that the negative side of it, especially in recent years with the standardization and the testing and all that, is swallowing up the democratic side of it. Now, what's the solution to that? Do you just get rid of public schools? That may be a little too extreme, but I'll stop there. there's one other thing he talks about as an example of this domestication and regulation of everything. He says, think about how much of our lives we spend indoors. Right, as modern people, we are inside buildings. You know, what percentage of our time? And the fact that we domesticate as much as we can the landscape around us. And you think of suburbia as the example of that. Right. So even when we're outside, we're not in nature so much. We're in this.
Yeah, but I wouldn't give it up.
Wouldn't give up what? Nature?
Gardening. No, again, he's not against gardening. He's he's just talking about the cultural need to surround ourselves with things that we control. So having a lawn instead of a prayree, for example, or something that would naturally...
You can't have a prairie around here, but anyway.
Okay. I'm thinking of my parents' street in Chicago.
Well, that might work there.
There was a neighbor who decided they would let the prairie grow, and none of the other neighbors liked it.
Yeah, I know. I know. Some people in Colorado build rock gardens in their front yard.
This family kept here. We're in the last 10 minutes of this course. And now we get to something positive here. So, in Ascent of Humanity, Eisenstein spends many, many pages arguing against how we understand Darwinian evolution. And you know, there's this whole current generation, it's called the neo-Darwinists, it's like Richard Dawkins, that whole group of scientists, the selfish gene. So they understand Darwin in very mechanistic terms, that this struggle to survive, the genes that adapt to the environment will enable a species to succeed and to thrive, and it's completely impersonal. There's no purpose to it. It's just this mechanical kind of struggle that takes place at a genetic level. And Eisenstein says that's just completely incorrect understanding of how evolution works. It reflects our cultural values and it leaves out so much about what how nature works and how evolution works. He says, let's not think of evolution as a struggle to survive. Let's think of it as nature at play. That really we are here as animals, as creatures, to play, to trial and error, to experiment, to interact with the environment and see what happens and learn from that. Because the creativity of play is spontaneous, unbidden, and impervious to any rote formalization, we must consider that it comes from a source beyond ourselves. We are the universe's channel for play. This is a whole different way of thinking.
That sounds religious to me.
Huh. Well, ascribing any kind of sacred text or rituals or ministers or priests, he's just saying life came about somehow. We don't control it. It's evolving somehow. We can't manage that. Let's allow it to flow. No, not capitalized.
But he acknowledges that mystery of life.
It's a mystery, yeah. It's something beyond our understanding. Maybe you want to call this religious, but he says there is some apparent purpose. Now, it's not intelligent design, the way that's understood, but there seems to be some, that life has some purpose. It wants to go somewhere. It wants to thrive. It wants to expand and experiment. Take that as you will. And so he says, if we allow ourselves to play, if we allow ourselves to be in this frame of mind where we allow the human mind to evolve, to be creative, it gets back to Proust's point, we allow ourselves to be creative and imaginative, then a more beautiful world is possible. We can bring it into being. We are entering this period of transition that's between worldviews. We're letting go of this worldview that we've had for hundreds of years. And it's scary. It means we have to let go of part of our identity. He says our deepest wounds are exposed. Maybe this whole new awareness about the treatment of women is part of that. These wounds that have been, and in race, right? Our wounds that have been put under the carpet are being exposed. We have to deal with this now. It's painful. But he also says this is sacred space because letting go of the old opens it up. We don't know what's possible now, what new ways of being might come forward. So let's embrace this transition, this uncertain time, and then together we can forge a whole new worldview. So this is for Deborah, even accepting the orange man in the White House, right? So he says, occasionally something happens that is so absurd, so awful, or so manifestly unjust that it penetrates our cultural narrative and causes people to question much of what they've taken for granted. Such events present a cultural crisis. So he's saying we should welcome those. We should accept that these outrageous things are showing us that the system itself really is coming apart. When things fall apart, the hopelessly radical becomes common sense. So new things are possible which wouldn't have been considered possible at the height of the old system. And finally, in his book on the more beautiful world, he says, we need to rediscover the mind of nature, to return to our original animism and the ensouled universe it perceived. ENSOULED, ensouled. We need to re-enchant the world, re-embrace the mystery. And out of that will come, we don't know what it looks like, but it'll be a world that's better than what we've got. So see, we ended up on a positive note.